outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
My son's riding across the country.
I knew that.
Doing this ride for water.
I knew it.
They're like on day five, and they had to trek through snow over the Sierras.
Over the Sierras? They haven't got the Rockies yet?
I think...
They got to be near the Rockies.
They were the Sierra Nevadas, and the road they're taking.
Yeah,
they had to get up, and it was tough climb, and they're very happy they're done with those. But I think they're able to slip through without having to go to the full elevations of the Rockies because of the route they chose. And I think they chose wisely given the snow.
Do they carry chains for those bikes?
No, they don't.
Do they make bike chains? I know there's bike chains, but they're not for the tires.
No, and what's crazy is I think there's only one guy on the team that really is any kind of a competitive cyclist. Everyone else is an enthusiast. And my son has become this awesome little cyclist. I mean, it's amazing. He just loves climbing. I'm just going, okay, where did you get that? Because I got pictures of him as a little guy throwing his bike down in frustration.
Yeah. I've probably done that a few times in my life.
But for 52 days, they're going across the entire country to try to raise awareness for folks that need clean water.
So where is he today?
They are, I think, probably somewhere going towards, out of Nevada towards Utah.
Wow, long way to go.
They do.
We were in Colorado last week because Sarah and I were going to go visit our son who lives out there now. And we were going to spend a couple days up in Breckenridge to do a little hiking in the mountains because we enjoy that. And
you should have brought your skis.
Man, I didn't know March 20th is a major snowstorm affair up there.
May.
That's, I'm sorry. March, May. Yes. That's how tired I am. I just got back yesterday, but yeah, May is snowing up there. There's a 20-car pileup we passed on the way up the mountain there from Denver to get up to Breckenridge, and then pretty much we were landlocked in our room the entire time.
Those people ought to be experienced of driving in snow, even if it's May.
You would think.
You would think.
I'm not sure. I never heard the cause of the accident. I know when we got there, it was hours later. Because we got to the airport and saw the road was closed.
That's just nasty.
It's on the side, not the one we were using. It was on the eastbound, and we were westbound. But yeah, by the time we got there, there were still like 8 tow trucks hauling cars out of places that cars shouldn't have been in.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think anybody died in that, but it was quite a mess, and I don't think I ever heard what caused it. But
wow.
So yeah, but it's first time in Breckenridge. We had a good time and enjoyed being with Sarah for our 44th anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Woo.
And then we got to spend
you guys re-upped?
Time with my son. I gave her another contract for a year. Yeah.
Just a year? You're on a year-to-year basis?
Oh, that's the key to a good marriage. You keep them guessing. No, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. No, Sarah and I have been in this thing a long time, and I see no reason to end it now. My gosh, it's never been better.
You ever heard of Heart Light Ministries?
Heart Light. L-I-T-E, L-I-G-H-T, how we spell that?
H-E-A-R-T, Light.
I get the heart part.
Yeah.
Heart Life with an F.
Light, L-I-G-H-T.
Okay. Hey, okay.
Light.
No, never. Obviously not.
Okay. Well, Jonathan.
Obviously not.
Jonathan is... once he's done riding across country, he's going to go to work for them. And it's just one of these great places where they kind of take kids who've kind of on the down and out and they need to have profound turnaround. And he is so passionate about investing in the lives and living this out 24/7. It sounds like the absolute dream job for the way he's wired as far as following Jesus and being involved in people's lives. And it's just been amazing to kind of just take a look at this ministry and what he's doing and who he's going to be invested in and just their whole commitment. Everything that you and I talk about in terms of our follow, these guys have somehow found a way to do that to help troubled young kids.
Is it a residential facility?
Yep.
Is it a counseling center? Or what?
Yeah, it's not like a full on prison, but it's like they're sent there. And it's like they're there for like a year.
Oh, wow.
And it's like they kind of just, they're living life together as they love people to turning the light on in their heart.
How cool is that?
It's really cool.
That's cool. Yeah, I've been asked to do for the city of Thousand Oaks.
What have you been asked to do?
There's a group of people wanting to get together and have kind of a healing / storytelling event to coincide with the borderline shooting first anniversary and the fires that ravaged Thousand Oaks. And still, there's no community that they know of in the U.S. that's had twin tragedies like that right on top of each other, from mass shooting to fires that ravaged the area and ravaged people's homes. So they really – there's some people that I really believe in the power of storytelling. So that gets some first responders to share stories. You get people who were survivors to tell stories. And that provides an environment in which some real healing can take place. Because they say some people won't talk about their experience up till a year or even longer afterwards, just because it's too emotional for them. And then finding safe places and good listeners to hear people's stories and be part of that. And I got contacted by a pastor in town who knows me and said, would you be willing to help us do this storytelling thing? And I'm not
awesome.
I'm not even sure what I'm going to do yet. I don't know what I bring to that other than the capacity to help people tell story and find a way to put those stories either in book form or website form or something, a video form down the road.
You know how to help heal hearts and draw that out.
So I'm real excited because one of the things I'm not real connected to is this community. I have friends in the area, but in terms of the community as a whole, I travel too much. I've not been connected. So, and I've been praying over the last year or so that there would be opportunity somehow. And I've tried a couple of different things and just hadn't seemed to fit. And this is looking pretty fun. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, one of the people who's a spiritual director, another tradition, Christian, but different from me. But she reached out and said, hey, I want to get to know you better. So we're going to.
Nice.
Yeah, we'll see where God takes that. So who knows?
Very good.
I do like telling stories.
And you
do. I do like other people finding healing. So it'd be fun. Hey, I've got this for you. I don't know if you've seen this article, Atlantic Monthly, June 2019. You read the Atlantic all the time?
No, don't. Yeah. I gave up my subscription a long time ago.
Yeah, Truth in Advertising. I do not subscribe to this either. I only see it because it was linked to something else I was reading, and it linked to this. And I thought, what an interesting thing. This is written by James Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. He's an author. He's a historian and journalist. Written a number of books. Big-time Catholic reformer, I guess.
Okay.
I didn't know him before this article, but he is well-known. He also studied for the priesthood, to give you context.
Okay.
Was a priest for 5 years and left it for reasons that I'll tell you about in a little bit.
Okay.
The title of the article is this, To Save the Church, Dismantle the Priesthood. Yeah. You can see why I would click on that link, right?
That is surefire clickbait for you.
I'm like going, what? People are actually saying this out loud. And I didn't
in
have
print.
It. And I have any and. To the Atlantic. That's a big magazine here in the States. And I'm like...
That's a weird conversation to have to the Atlantic.
Oh, yeah. Maybe. They do quasi-religious overtoned kinds of things now
still,
and then.
Still, but it's not like one of their center points.
Yeah. This was the kind of the summary of the article. To save the church, Catholics must detach themselves from the clerical hierarchy and take the faith back into their own hands.
Okay, is this coming on the heels of all the clergy abuse and all the pedophilia stuff and all that stuff?
It is a big part of that.
Okay.
He talks about the pedophilia thing, and I think he has some ties to Ireland because a whole lot about the Magdalene laundries and ways impoverished people, orphans and widows. Widows were used to as slave labor and sometimes sex trade, and all, so it's part of that. And then he makes some statements, I think you and I, and I'm not going to pile on the Catholic Church because I don't think there's anything going on in the Catholic Church that hasn't been going on in other.
No, the Protestant Church is not a whole lot of different. They just don't wear robes.
And they're not as massive. But boy, when you Southern Baptist report on sexual abuse that's gone on and almost every week in Protestant and pastorpreneur churches where people are just starting churches for their own good. Where something doesn't come out of a abusive nature sexually or just authoritarian kinds of things. But so, yes, he does bring up the statistics from all of that. And gosh, the report the Ryan Commission published in 2009, he said, despite government inspections and supervision, Catholic clergy had across decades violently tormented thousands of children. And so he says, church authorities have not only successfully silenced the victims, they've deflected law enforcement and shielded the predators. The virtue of the Catholic faith have been obvious to me my whole life. The world is better for those virtues, and I cherish the countless men and women who bring the faith alive. And this is what I really like about the article. It's not, it's all bad, kill it.
Right.
It's some bad apples are killing the wonderful good that even he's talking about the Catholic Church does. He said, the Catholic Church is a worldwide community of well over 1 billion people. It crosses all borders. The church is the largest non-government organization on the planet through which selfless women and men care for the poor, teach the unlettered, heal the sick, and work to preserve minimal standards of the common good. Hmm. That's a pretty good statement about it all. And then he talks about Vatican II and some of the things that he was excited about, the Vatican II trying to reform in the Catholic Church. You won't have time to go into all that. But he said this, that one thing the Vatican II did not take up is the issue of clericalism, the vesting of power in an all-male and all-celibate clergy. My 5 years in the priesthood, even in its most liberal wing, gave me a fetid taste of this caste system. Mm. Clericalism is both the underlying cause and the ongoing enabler of the present Catholic catastrophe. Mm. That's kind of the some statement of the whole article.
Does he speak beyond just their list of abusive and awful kind of predatory sins? I mean, is he looking at this in a broader context or in reaction to that?
No, I think it's in a broader context. And he does talk about the current pope coming from a priesthood kind of mentality and great hope that there would be reformation in all of these things because of the new pope, 6 years now into his term. But that it hasn't. The same things haven't happened. The same hiding, the same obfuscating, the same, you know, not owning up to the problems. And even now, it's being these things are coming out in media and whatever because it's absolutely the world has demanded that you give an account, not because they've wanted to.
Does he see just the sheer vesting of power in a clerical order as being an impediment to the rest of the body? I mean, just it's like the negative one, sure, for the damage it does.
Yeah, yeah.
But what about the guys that they're good and they're not doing the bad thing, but there's still that vested power of professionals? Does he talk about
any of that? Yeah, he does. And he talks about, you know, it's not just the bad apples that did stuff. It was protected by all the quote unquote good apples, right?
Well-intentioned ones.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, we're trying to save the reputation of the church. We're trying to do whatever we're doing. So the cover up and the fact that enabled these people goes on. One of his statements that I thought we really, really could talk about forever, and this goes way beyond just the abuses of sexual abuse and those kind of things. He said, a power structure that is accountable only to itself will always end up abusing the powerless.
Mm.
And I don't
know. Gosh, I wish that wasn't true. You know?
I hear you. I wish it wasn't true too, but we don't have a good historical record.
No, I know. That's why I'm not fighting against the statement, but I just go like, gosh, I wish that wasn't true.
I do too.
Because it's like if we really understood what, quote, the power was for or what power really is, or even just that the notion that, oh, you're set apart for this as a function. I don't know why we've turned it into titles and thrones and privilege. I get that it's in the heart of man that can do that, but I don't know why we've done that when it's like the model that Jesus gave was servanthood. And it was not lording over.
Truly not.
You know, I mean, when I think of Jesus' little statements on leadership, and it's like, don't call yourselves that.
Right.
Because you got one father, one teacher.
Yeah, but he said rabbi, and he didn't say things like pastor and priest. He didn't use, that's how people get around that.
I know crazy. That, but it's sort of like, wait a minute. I think the principle's right there that we're stumbling over in our particulars.
Maybe the Amplified gets to all those things.
Maybe
that verse is four pages long.
In the Amplified of all the titles and roles and positions.
Yeah.
Because Jesus is never nullifying the function. But he is dissing the title.
He is. And I think the other thing that this kind of undercurrent gets to, which you and I have experienced enough of, is in church-related things, I'm using quotes, air quotes around church, it's the spiritual leader is also the political leader of the entity, right? Uh-huh. So there, it's not just a matter of how I help people grow in Christ. It's also how we spend the money and how we manage the program. And it confuses to...
Yeah, he's the gatekeeper of the resources.
Always.
And I think that's where it's like, that's where unfortunately the effectual life of the body is now greatly hindered by the cork in the bottle.
Yep.
Because it all comes down to that guy validating it, that guy disseminating it,
yeah.
that guy authorizing
yeah.
it as the man with the vision from God for all of us.
Yeah, and the first denomination I worked in 40-some-odd years ago, it taught that as a matter of doctrine. That the senior pastor is the physical representation of
He's
Jesus
the Moses.
To the community. In fact, I even remember being said, don't come to me with stuff that you think God has for us to do, whatever. God speaks to me, I speak to you, and you go and do unquestioned.
You said that?
No. That was said to me.
Said to you. Okay.
At the
Good.
Time, at Say. The time, I got a little throw up Phew. In my throat, just a little bit, and I'm thinking, I won't be here long.
But here's the problem. I think... The people of God did that. When God wanted Moses to bring the whole people to the mountain and consecrate them because I'm going to speak to everybody.
Yeah, not going
to
do it.
They ran away in fear and they said, Moses, you go talk to him. This is our idea. You go talk to him. You come back, tell us what he said, and we'll do it.
We'll do everything.
I mean, that's the unfortunate where man invented our inherited model of church.
It goes back to that inherent need for some people, probably 90% of people want a king. I want somebody just to tell me what to do and I'll do
yeah.
it. Even though they don't. Even though Israel didn't
they
do what most...
They don't really want a
yeah.
king, but they want the freedom from the responsibility that they want to put on the king.
And then there's about 10% of us that really want to be the king. That really...
This is oh, not good.
As long as you pay me well...
Because...
Right?
So you got 90% that don't want to be the king, 10% that do want to be the king.
These are not.
And now you've explained the lack of a single Protestant pope, but the many popes.
Yeah, this is not Barna research statistics. These are just observational, anecdotal realities that I've witnessed. I do know people who love to be the king, and not necessarily because even the first place I was at.
But they're good king.
I don't think
they're going to be a good king.
I don't think the guy wanted to be the king. He felt it was his responsibility to be the king. It wasn't. I've met power guys who just want to be in control of everything. He wasn't that, but his understanding of what "quote unquote" the pastor is put him in that space where I have to be in charge. And then when he says, like, the only account
is that the sheepdog responsibility that he's feeling? Is it?
I think it was put on him in Bible school or pastor seminars, whatever. That's your job. That's what
the
job
is.
This
is the pastor's yes. job description.
Yes,
I am. I must give an account for these people before God.
Yeah. And obviously, everybody doing it is doing what they think they know best. One thing I read over this break time I had with Sarah, a little bit of vacation, I did some reading. One of the things was, what if all the horrible despots that have ever existed on the planet, from Stalin to Hitler to whatever, and he was making the case, the book I was reading, I forget the name of it now, so I can't help you there, but because it wasn't a book, it was an article, actually, so I don't remember the article, but it was actually saying, these people thought they had a better view of society than anyone else, that what they were doing was for everyone's good. And so if you oppose them, you had to be...
You're just misguided Neanderthal. You're in the way.
Yeah, you had to be either tormented into complicity or you have to be excised from the community. One of the two. Yeah. Now, listen to this. You're going to love this.
Okay.
Listen, I love this. This man, James Carroll, says this. I left the priesthood 45 years ago. And he said, I didn't know it at the time, but clericalism was the reason. Its origins lie not in the Gospels,
yeah.
but in the attitudes and organizational charts of the late Roman Empire. Christianity was very different at the beginning. The first reference to the Jesus movement in a non-biblical source comes from the Jewish Roman historian Flavius Josephus. Writing around the same time the Gospels were taking form, Josephus described the followers of Jesus as, this is what you're going to love, those that loved him at the first and did not let go of their affection for him.
Wow.
That's how they were first written about in a secular source.
Because that doesn't distill itself down to an acronym, we lost the power of what he just said.
Those that loved him at the first and did not let go of that affection.
See, that ought to be the definition of a follower.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that.
What else?
That would solve most of our problems, would it not?
Would it not? Fell in love with him and never let go. And that's first love, right? You've left your first love. You forgot that he's in love with you and you can be in love with him and live in that affection.
How cool that a historian back in the day, that's what he's left with in terms of the observation.
Yeah. And it's just as tragic that we diverted from that so quickly to create institutions in the very stamp of the failing Roman Empire. Now, when Sarah and I went to Rome a few years back after I had some time in Spain, I did some reading alongside Roman history, right alongside, because I'd been to the Vatican too as part of that, the rise of the popes. And reading these two different things side by side, and one of the authors actually made the point that when the Roman Empire was imploding on itself, the wealthy families that had been for years putting their golden boys against each other to see who'd be the next emperor started pushing their golden boys into the papacy, because Rome got to be the Archbishop of Rome became the first apostle among all the others. So when the Roman Empire was no longer something to fight for, the papacy was. So the same ambition to be emperor,
to be in charge,
fell into how the church was founded, but small church and Catholic church, which there was only one back in the day, which is just so eye-opening to go, okay, that makes sense then why everything that we have is patterned in the DNA of the Roman Empire and human institutions and human structures and political realities and all that stuff than it is people who fell in love with Jesus and never let go.
But I'm asking because I don't know that I actually know the answer.
Okay.
When this was the description of who the followers were, prior to Constantine, blessing and curse that he was,
right?
Why did it leave this description and allow itself to become institutionalized?
Well, this is now, you know, obviously 300, 350 years before August. This is a long time before. But you go back to some of the early church writings. One of the, a man I met, and we talked about this in a previous podcast, but a man I met in Australia was talking about how in the time of the early apostles, the early church that we read about that's contemporaneous with the New Testament, you got the definition of an elder being guardians of a gift. The gift is Christ in you, the hope of glory. And an elder guards that gift. An elder wants you to explore that gift, wants you to experience it, wants to keep away hindering influences that are going to try and control that gift in you or control you in spite of that gift. Guardians of a gift. And he said in the time of Ignatius, who was John's disciple, so you're talking about one generation away
like
from
100, 150?
Yeah, yeah, early on. When he becomes, I think, the bishop at Antioch, what he starts to teach is elders are guardians of right faith and practice.
So even there.
Yeah, even then. You're already making a shift.
Heart light's gone.
Which is somebody's desire to control, right? Because if you're going to have an institution, and we can talk about it, not just Catholicism, talk about any church you want in town today, in this town. If you're going to have an entity that's going to own property and pay salaries, suddenly you've got an entity that is supposed to be the church, supposed to protect the values of the church, but in fact, it runs off the political decisions as to where the money goes and what program we have and who's on the stage. And those become all the factors so much immediately. You can't have an institution without conformity.
No.
You can't.
I know, which is very frustrating.
Because we've got to believe the same things. We've got to come in at the same time. We've got to have people, responsible people in the various church ministries. And that takes a leader who's good at managing money and getting people to do what needs to be done, mostly volunteers, to make this thing work.
Yeah. Why – I don't know, but why did Ignatius, follower of John, who's best friend of Jesus, why did he redefine the elders like that?
I don't have the research. I don't know.
Because that's the tragic moment. From first generation experiencers to second generation hearers.
And I'm sure it wasn't a moment. I'm sure Ignatius didn't wake up one day and say, you know what we could do here? We could change the whole definition of eldership.
Yeah, I doubt he even thought he was. I bet in codifying his understanding of it, he was as sincere as he possibly could be with thinking that's the job. I gotta keep the doctrine pure. Because I do know at the time you had different, you know, because they started holding the apostolic councils because they had a bunch of crazy other ideas that were like, well, we're not so sure about that no more.
Right.
And so out of a desire to went like, wait a minute, let's talk about this.
Right.
That seems like crazy thinking. They branded some guys who were differing from the others as heretics, whether they were or not. I'm not defending heretics everywhere, but you just sit there and go like, okay.
Some of them were, clearly.
Yes, yes, yes. But you just go like, gosh, I would imagine if that became the dominant element where they are, quote, contending for the faith because it's now being discussed by second-generation hearers as opposed to first-generation. Because they use the canon of Scripture. If you can tie this book to one of the eyewitness people, then we can attest to its validity and why it's there.
Yeah.
And if that's at all in question, well, then we throw that one out. And you're going like, okay, the second generation debaters.
Well, that's even fourth and fifth generation. We talked about right. The canon. Yeah, right.
True.
We're way
yeah,
downstream.
Yeah, but the thing that they would always try to take authorship down is how do we get back to somebody who's an eyewitness, someone who was there as being some sort of authoritative claim.
To what? Determine right faith and practice.
Yes.
That when we lost that gift in you, God dwells in you. And I'm no longer guarding the gift. I'm going to tell you what I think is better for you.
Okay, so here's popping in my head is this question. How do you guard that gift in someone else? What's that look like?
I think it puts as primary importance the knowing of God, the knowing of Christ.
That can't be done for you. You have to do that.
What guardian of right faith and practice does, it makes relationship with God optional.
Oh, gosh.
We don't need it. Yes, it'd be nice if you have it. Yes, God wants it. But we only know if God's in you if you're following the right faith and practice we've decided. And so instead of
having— you've already lost him.
Yes. And yet there's always been people who begin to say, hold it a minute. I think God wants to be the voice in our life, the shepherd who leads us. My sheep know my voice. And people begin to see that stuff, begin to buy into it. And then what's been crazy over 2,000 years is they leave that massive structure that won't be compliant with the Holy Spirit anymore and start their own. And within 20, 30, 40 years, it's become the very thing they got out of. Because if you're going to think of the church as institutional, you're always going to, conformity has to be the goal, not transformational, discovery, not yeah. You get to know God. Yes, you get to make some stupid choices and stupid mistakes because you're learning to follow him. No, we don't have time for that now. We need to make sure people get it right from the beginning, and we'll just tell them what it is.
What's so crazy is this is what is in man that he's prone to do.
Yes.
Because they did that in the Old Testament too.
Yes.
God's gate, hey, your festivals, your moons, all that other stuff, that's a stench in my nostrils. I mean, that's not a good, encouraging word that says, oh, yeah, I love what you're doing.
I love Isaiah saying, I don't even attend those anymore, and you don't even miss me. That's God saying to Israel. I don't even go to the festivals he prescribed.
Yeah.
I'm not even going anymore. Because the point for God was never that we're always doing the right thing, that we're growing to know him and let him transform us internally.
They were points of engagement and celebration. They were intended to be points of engagement and celebration of who he was as being a very active part in their lives as something celebratory of what life is there. I mean, every single one of the festivals points towards some aspect of that.
Right.
And when they're just going through the motions, Jesus has never been excited. God the Father, Old Testament, the stench. And you're just going like...
The stench.
The stench.
The
and you're
stench.
Just going like, okay, wow. Because if an elder's job is to be a guardian of the gift that's in you, because we've been looking at the whole, you know, spiritual gifts things, and it's like, I'm going like, I think the gift is the gift of the Holy Spirit. And I don't think he comes into anyone's life restrictively. I'm not sure that there's, oh, you just have the one gift. I don't know, you have the gift.
Right.
And then if you're in relationship with the giver of the gifts and the one who's resident within you, then whatever's kind of needed could be manifest in and through you because the giver is dwelling there.
Right. And you could have the space in which to grow up in that reality.
Yes.
And what conformity can't do is give you the space to grow up in that reality. So we teach you behavior instead of relationships, we teach you doctrine instead of faith, instead of growing trust in who God is. I've been thinking about this the other day. I wrote down in my journal. There's a difference between having people subscribe to the faith as a defined entity
and
having trust, growing trust in who God is. So by calling it the faith, even, We've taken that step away from, we've always
taken it from a verb to a noun.
Institutionalism always makes relationship with God
dead,
non-essential. It's not important. In fact, you growing up to honor the gift in you is only going to cause problems for us because we're trying to provide a slick,
that's the messy stuff, tricked out.
We're not going there.
Predictable stuff.
So listen, let me go on because there's two more paragraphs I've got here that I think are really wonderful. It says, for years, I refused to cede my faith to the corruptions of the institutional church.
Nice. I love that.
Yeah, refused to cede my faith. But Vatican bureaucracies and self-serving inquisitors are not the issue now. The priests are. In the American and African, in European, Asian, and Australian churches, wherever there were Catholic priests, there were children being preyed upon and tossed aside. Were it not for crusading journalists and lawyers, the sexual abuse of children by Catholic priests would still be hidden and rampant. And that's when he uses the statement
it's
I read earlier.
Different definition power, of celibate.
A power structure that is accountable only to itself will always end up abusing the powerless.
See, but what's so bizarre is if they had the gift of the Spirit dwelling within,
you couldn't countenance this.
Yeah.
You couldn't. No, that's true.
I mean, it's like the idea of, oh, you know, who am I accountable to, or I'm just accountable to myself. Not if he's there.
Right.
Yeah, because, I mean, we go back to the, like, I wish that wasn't true. It's like, wait a minute. If you got a whole bunch of empowered people, but they got nothing dwelling within, that's a recipe for danger. I mean, run.
And the reality seems to be those who do have the Spirit within don't gravitate toward institutional power.
No.
That's the other side of it.
Because they know what real power is.
Yeah, and they know in the long run, I've got to abuse you to make you the way I want you to if I'm the one conforming you to my expectations instead of I'm the one equipping you to follow him.
That's them exerting their power on you as opposed to being a guardian of the power that dwells in you.
Yeah.
Because if my job is to be jealous for the reality of God to become alive in you, I can't usurp that.
Right.
That's my control over the abuse of power. If what I know my job is that life may happen in you and flow in and through you, then I can't pretend to be that life. I'm not going to put the stopper in the bottle. I'm not going to be the arbiter of that life. I'm going to be jealous for that life to become real.
Because if I don't let you access that gift, I am robbing you of the most precious thing that the life of Jesus is.
Well, yeah, it's like you are going to be in the way of them experiencing life.
And you are, when you do get in the way, you and I have been there. You've been in the way of someone who thinks they know God's will better than you.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to resort at nothing. What are you going to stop at? If I know best for you, and I have a responsibility to make you do what God wants you to
then
do.
Then you will manipulate me.
Where will I not stop at that? So what he basically says is the clergy, the clerical system is the problem.
Yes.
We Catholics need to throw it out and give the church to the people. Now,
is that not what the rending of the veil was suggestive of?
Yeah. But when you think about now, okay, let's just fire all of the priests. They got all get real jobs and maybe some of them will get wives and they can move on. You take it out of, you know, men, allegedly celibate men, and you give it to the people of God. You know what you're going to have to do? Because of all the massive resource that the Catholic Church holds, you got to put people in power to protect the buildings. And it may be
You sell them.
Yeah, well, there you go.
You sell them.
That's not going to happen.
You give each one of the official guys a little golden parachute. Gives him no. Let's
make it silver. I'm not giving him a golden parachute.
Okay,
come on, let's be serious.
A parachute that allows them to actually jump without fearing that they're gonna, you know, just plummet to the ground. Sell all those resources. Give it all away. Give it to the poor. Don't worry about your buildings and let life happen, dude. I think that'd be revival.
It would be.
I think that'd be awesome.
Except we can't let go. Somebody's gonna like start a Bible study. They're gonna start a meeting, worship service. Then you got to decide who's on the team, who's not on the team, who's spiritual enough, who's not spiritual enough.
But
it doesn't matter if it's clergy people.
No, I
know, or non-clergy people.
But no, there's got to be a way that we can gather without having to do all that.
We haven't.
But that doesn't mean we can't.
No, I hear you. Listen to this, though. This is what I love. Okay. I love this paragraph. This is right at the end of the article. He says, the future, because he says, what do people say? You can't just give it to the clergy. It's not going to work. All this stuff. He said, and this is what he writes. The future will come at us invisibly, frame by frame, as it always does. Comprehensible only when it runs together and projected retrospectively at some distant moment. But it is coming. The church I foresee will be governed by lay people. Though I hate that word. Although the verb govern may apply less than serve. What remains of the connection to Jesus once the organizational apparatus disappears? This is what I asked myself in the summer before I resigned from the priesthood all those years ago. A summer spent at a Benedictine monastery in a hill between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And I came to realize that the question answers itself. The church, whatever else it may be, is not the organizational apparatus. It is a community of memory, keeping alive the story of Jesus Christ. The church is in the flesh connection to him, or it is nothing. The church is the fellowship of those who follow him, of those who seek to imitate him, a fellowship to repeat the earliest words ever used about us, of those that loved him at the first and did not let go of their affection for him.
That would solve everything.
That gives me goosebumps, man, just reading that stuff. It does. And I like this, that the future will come. This church, we're talking about it before we even turn on the mic.
Jesus
today
is going to build his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail.
The whole institutional religious church Christianity thing is imploding in the midst. Even people who lead them are very aware that this is not going to have a long term.
Which I think is awesome.
Yeah, I do too.
I'm so excited that a bunch of poobahs of sitting on top of movements and empires are coming to the realization this is not it. This was not what he was talking about.
And the other people wondering, what's going to be left? What's going to happen? I love what he says. The future is already taking shape in ways you can't see, where people are already living in connection with Christ and learning to relate to each other as guardians of a gift instead of conformers to get people's expectations met, already forming. You can't see it until enough of that mashes into itself where it becomes visible. But until then, it's still coming. It's still unfolding. And that, I tell you, when I travel around the world, when I sit and talk to people, I get glimpses of that. There are so many people learning to live this differently, treat each other differently. I think in time, those who have just, you know, I'm just sticking myself in an institution because I feel safe there. The day's going to come when not only you're not going to feel safe there, and already some of you shouldn't feel safe there because you're not, you're at risk, but also going to come the day where you're going to wish you had found your way to a different gift much earlier.
Yeah, and I know we're near at the end, but when the guy came up with the definition of elder and said is guardian of the gift, I mean, I'm sure the Holy Spirit helped him understand that, but that's extraordinary. I've been to seminary, got the degree. Nobody ever defined an elder like that.
Yeah, and I don't think he's working from some – just give my conversation with him. This is years ago in Australia, and I didn't do the research. But to give my conversation with him, he wasn't saying he found some ancient text that defined eldership that way.
No, no.
He was talking about the way eldership expressed itself.
Yeah.
They were guarding a gift in people. And you already have, even in the New Testament, people trying to take away that gift. You already have that happening.
But where do you see that? I would love to know. Where did he make that observation, or where was that observation shared? Because somebody had to realize that really is the best definition of what an elder is meant to do if he has a guarding function, what he's actually guarding. Because when it becomes, I'm now guardian of the faith, that's a little switch, but it's a massive difference.
Well, because guardian of right faith and practice makes me the rule keeper, or the rule maker, and the rule keeper, the rule enforcer.
Yeah.
It's both. And now you're, and that's so many elders, they sit in their little elders meetings and decides, what are they deciding? Are they saying, how do we help
that's
people follow Jesus better?
That's what they think their job is.
Yeah, but they're not.
I know.
I look back at the thousands of elders meetings I've attended. And all of our discussion was not about how do we guard the gift here and free people to the fullest expression of a growing relationship with Jesus that we can. We said that even at the church I pastor. One of the things we taught our leadership, here's what we say to people. When you first meet them, they first come around church, is, man, how's your relationship with Jesus going? And is there anything we can do to help you make it better?
That's a great thing to say.
That was a great thing to say. But we merged into a group of us, and this is where I got kicked out, a group of us know the will of God better for the rest of us.
That was the dysfunction of the Old Testament. That was the rejection of the people to the voice of God.
And I stood against that and said, there's just no way. That's not what this is about. If we're not equipping people to follow Jesus, then we're just playing some kind of religious game for either our own amusement, our own responsibility, or our own income track. But we're not letting the Church of Jesus Christ thrive in the world.
Oh, that real elders would emerge.
Oh, man. People that loved him at the first and did not let go of their affection for him.
That's good.
I love that.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.